Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm curious, how can getting a better knowledge of writing and philosophy help people enjoy their favorite movies and TV shows more?
A piece of media, whether it's a TV show or a film or a book, it's almost a lens through which to look at the world. It's an ideological lens. And I think that by studying these ideological lenses, not only can we introduce new ideas to people, but we can allow for people to engage more critically with everything around them.
Hi, I'm Cody Goff with the critically engaged Curiosity.com.
And I'm Ashley Hamer. Today, we're going to help you enjoy your favorite movies and TV shows even more than you already were.
Every week, we explore what we don't know because curiosity makes you smarter.
This is the Curiosity Podcast. Think about your favorite TV show or movie. Why do you love it so much? What's that secret Szechuan sauce that makes it so special?
Today's guest has dedicated his career to helping you understand what movies and TV shows like South Park and Rick and Morty are trying to tell us.
Jared Bauer is the co-founder and head of content at Wisecrack, which produces hit YouTube series like Thug Notes, 8-Bit Philosophy, Earthling Cinema, The Philosophy of Everything, What Went Wrong, and more.
Wisecrack is focused on exploring big ideas and meaningful topics through the lens of pop culture and media, and Jared argues that that's a really important thing to do.
Here's why.
Let's say you're watching something like Fight Club. Let's say you're watching something that you really love. I think that on a very basic level, what we do is kind of arm people or equip them with verbiage, with ways of explaining or contextualizing, why is it that that movie just gave me this high? You know, people watch Fight Club and they say, oh my God, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen. But it's very hard to put into words why it affects you so much. And by using a critical lens and exploring the ideas, I think that on a subconscious level, people are in a sense aware that these movies are dealing with ideas that perhaps resonate with an individual because they reflect a struggle that they're going through in life, or it asks big questions that they've been asking themselves. And throughout the movie, these questions are similarly explored. And we kind of put that into words for them so that they can, you know, on a very basic level, someone says, oh, Fight Club's your favorite movie. Well, why? And instead of just saying, well, that Brad Pitt has a really sexy six-pack, you know, you can hopefully say something a little bit more insightful that also allows you to reflect on struggles or conflicts or thoughts that you are experiencing in your own life, and just kind of also allow you to look critically at yourself and say, why is it that these things resonate me and these things don't? What does that say about my life? What does that say about the society that I live in and how society is affecting me, et cetera, et cetera? But on top of that, I think that one thing that analyzing the humanities can do for people, at least the idealistic mission statement for me, is that it allows, A, you to put yourself into someone else's shoes. I think that empathy is something that studying media and literature can help increase, but also inform you on the choices that you make and the way that you treat other people. I think that science and math, although I love that stuff and I love learning about that stuff and I'm a big fan of your podcast, I think that one of the things that the humanities can do is help inform your choices, the choices that you make. And that's, I think, where the humanities is a bit underappreciated in the way that it can bring more to people's lives.
Your background is in the humanities, right? You have a PhD in philosophy?
No, I've never taken a philosophy class in my life. I actually just have a bachelor's of science in filmmaking from the University of Texas. The way I put it to people is that filmmaking was my gateway drug to the humanities and to philosophy. There's a philosopher, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, but he has a thesis that film is a medium that does philosophy. Just based on the foundation that it's something that has a character that goes through a struggle and that struggle finds some sort of resolve, inherently there is going to be an ideological statement made in a TV show or a film or a book. And so I think that cinema and philosophy go very hand in hand. And so in a way, when I studied cinema, it was a very easy gateway drug, is the way I like to put it, into understanding philosophy and getting excited about philosophy. Because I wanted to know, like, oh my God, how is Christopher Nolan so good? How is Quentin Tarantino so good? How do these people affect me so profoundly? And although philosophy is not necessarily the answer, it was an answer that really resonated with me and really piqued my interest. And I just had to learn more and more and more about it. So, yeah, I'm just a filmmaker who got really curious about the humanities.
To make a couple reference points here, you mentioned Christopher Nolan. So you've talked about the Dark Knight series. You have separate podcasts individually for South Park and for Rick and Morty, which yeah. I want to ask you specifically about in a couple minutes, but we'll get to that. Your criticisms and analyses have covered everything from the latest Star Wars films to, again, Fight Club, as you've mentioned, and lots of other popular shows. You're attracted to film specifically, and some of what you talk about in your reviews explains how these productions are exploring ideas that are sometimes thousands of years old. They can go back to Aristotle or Plato or older or newer. Why do you think it's important to explore those ideas in a new way?
Okay, I actually want to just hear, I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, why is it important to learn about science?
Okay, let's do that. Why is it important to learn about science?
Oh, no, I'm asking you.
Oh, you want to hear from
me? Yeah, because, I guess, you know, just as playing devil's advocate, I'm just kind of curious to hear, it seems like because modern education does not emphasize, or at least public education does not emphasize hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the idea of interpreting a text. Basically, if you go to law school, you're basically doing hermeneutics for the rest of your life, and if you become a lawyer. So you could say that, yeah, doing wisecrack stuff can, like, train you to be a lawyer, but more than that, I mean, there is a more idealistic statement to it, but I guess I wanted to throw that back to you and say, other than just curiosity and making life more fulfilling, people ask, why are the humanities important, or why is it important to read cinema like it's some novel thing? But I guess I always just want to hear, okay, well, then why is the things that people take as a given, why are those important?
That's a very good question, honestly. And I think that there is value in understanding the world around you. And I think that for scientists and for people that consume content around the sciences, it's easy for them to point at something that is scientifically proven or observable in a concrete way and say, here's a thing I can look at and understand the world around me better. I think it's important to understand science to understand the constants or those concrete things around us. Look around and say, why does wood splinter? Why when I pour cold water in a hot glass might the glass shatter? So that you understand how to operate under the restrictions of the world around you and also look at the possibilities of what might come next. But that's more of how you can do things or the way in which you can do things, whereas the humanities, which I think is vitally important, is asking, why do we do these things? Or more importantly right. than that, why ought we do these things?
Right, but the interesting thing is, when I ask you why science is important, now you're doing philosophy. Because
you're
what you're saying can't be proven in an empirical or scientific method. So I think that people say, and I think that there's some sort of a statement that I saw that once you question why is science important, you're doing philosophy. So you can't really separate the two as much as one might think.
Yeah, they really do go in hand. And science ethics is an entire field of study, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
To get even more meta, there's also an entire field of study into the philosophy of science. I mean, think about it. Science is a method we use to know what's true. But how do you know science really does that? Why is it better to look for evidence to falsify your beliefs than to support them? What kind of evidence is good evidence? How do you know a scientific result is real and not just a blip in the data? Science has hard and fast answers for many of these questions, but humans had to come up with those answers. Those humans were philosophers. Philosophers like Aristotle, Francis Bacon, and René Descartes.
So, yeah, You've won the discussion.
No. I'm sorry. That was...
No. It all worked really well. I mean, I think if your answer is like, well, you tell me, and you're Socratic methoding me. I see what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's important to me, I think, because it's really hard these days to communicate new ideas to people. It's very hard to get people to even open themselves up to new ideas. I think that we live in a time where, because of technology, we're always inundated with so much information, so much stuff is culture has accelerated to a ridiculous rate, and people need a sense of comfort. they can't ingest all this information. So, you know, I mean, this is very much the discussion we have around bubbles, about ideological bubbles that people keep themselves in. I believe that you can't really just convince somebody that, hey, you're wrong, I'm right, or consider this idea. They're going to be resistant to it. And I actually feel empathy for these people who are resistant to it, because I don't blame them. There are enough problems going on in the world and in people's personal lives. They don't need extra challenges to their lives. So let me give you an example. One of the best videos we've ever made, and one of the ones that has given me the most inspiration for the work that we've done, is a video on the philosophy of an anime called Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. Are you familiar with it, Cody?
I've not seen Fullmetal Alchemist. It's on my list.
Before doing Wisecrack, I was not educated in anime at all. And I watched all 64 episodes of the anime, and I was blown away. One of the reasons why the show is so brilliant is because it questions whether science or faith is what is the arbiter of truth? And ultimately, it comes to a rather ambiguous conclusion that you can't put all your quote-unquote faith in science, nor can you do it with faith. And so that's an idea. Like, if you are a part of the new atheist movement, or you're someone of faith and your beliefs are very rigid, it's very hard for somebody to convince somebody like, hey, I'm going to challenge your beliefs. They're going to inherently resist that. It's kind of like, I always bring up the example in the movie Inception. Have you seen it, Cody?
Not seen Inception either.
Okay, well, there's a part where Leonardo DiCaprio is trying to convince Ken Watanabe that incepting an idea or putting an idea in someone's brain is impossible directly, because if I tell you, Cody, don't think about elephants, the first thing that's going to come to your mind is elephants. So in the same way, if I'm trying to convince you, who maybe you are a very rigid atheist, and I'm trying to convince you that there's value in faith, you're going to inherently be resistant to that idea, because it's something that you believe very firmly and you are already primed to try and disprove what I'm telling you. But let's say that you're a huge fan of Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood, that the characters really speak to you and the narrative is something that you revisit over and over and over again. Now imagine that I can use evidence and bring in a tangential philosophy that highlight and broaden the ideas of this anime that you love. And if I can convince you that these ideas are in the thing that's given meaning to your life, and I think that entertainment, television, movies, books, these are the things that give people meaning in their lives, then I can open up their minds. Then I can challenge them to think differently, because they already love the property. So one of the best emails we've ever gotten was from somebody saying that all my life I've felt very strongly that there is no God, and I've looked down upon people of faith. But after watching your video, I've reconsidered my position, and now I feel respect for people of faith. And just that kind of paradigm shift that can be done from an internet video is so profound. And that email that I received, and I've talked about it a couple times on the channel and on our podcasts, has been very meaningful to me, because that's ultimately the mission statement for me, is getting people to open their eyes, accept new ideas, and put themselves in other people's shoes. And I think that reaching people by the things that they already love is a really good way to give people a transformative experience.
According to many epistemologists, that is, people who are experts in the study of knowledge, all beliefs, even scientific theories, are based at least in part on faith. It just isn't possible for people to justify all of their beliefs. Even if it were, it would be impossible to justify all of the beliefs you use to justify your beliefs, and the beliefs that justify those beliefs, and so on. You believe A because of B, you believe B because of C, you believe C because of D. Where does it end? And if it does end, does that mean your beliefs aren't justified? At some point, you need to simply accept something as true without interrogating it. If that's not taking things on faith, what is?
You keep it entertaining, too. And
yeah, absolutely.
Most of what you do is very,
right,
very funny.
Yeah, we try, and the whole idea of Wisecrack is that, you know, we're going to explore big ideas, but we're going to not take ourselves too seriously. And at the end of the day, what do we know?
Exactly. You mentioned tribalism. Is that one of the reasons that you dedicated an entire podcast, an entire channel to South Park specifically?
Yeah. So I'm a huge South Park fan, and I think that South Park, Matt and Trey, actually my co-founder Jacob, who's actually right next to me, him and I do see Matt Stone and Trey Parker as idols of ours. And part of the reason is because they exist very outside of the kind of Hollywood ideological bubble. They don't give a who they offend. And it allows them to make political statements and make political satire that most other people in Hollywood, who are just trying to get a paycheck and, you know, maintain their reputation in Hollywood and get hired for another job, can't do. that's why I think it's really important to study South Park, because they can challenge the quote unquote groupthink of Hollywood or whatever. So you're going to see satirical points in South Park that just unfortunately can't come up in most media in Hollywood.
Yeah, the dominant, I guess, civil war going on in the United States right now is probably left versus right. I think most people can agree based on just looking at anything. And they tend to satirize both. But what I have found interesting is some of the feedback they've received is there are people on both sides that will watch their episodes and say, wow, I completely agree with this. But then often ascribe some of the things they're satirizing to the other side, even if they're really trying to satirize their side. How many people watching South Park do you think fully understand what they're getting at? And how do you think that you at Wisecracker are able to look at it objectively and interpret who they're trying to kind of poke fun at?
Interestingly enough, I think that's one of the great things about the show. So at Wisecrack, we have contributors with a variety of beliefs. So we have some people who would consider themselves, you know, like far left commies, and we have people who are libertarians. And it's actually really nice is that some episodes, particularly this most recent season, season 21, there was the pilot episode was called White People Renovating Houses. And it was supposed to be a nuanced look at, you know, the specter of automation and the whole Charlottesville thing and blue collar workers who are unable to find jobs and the rise of Trump, all that stuff. And it's very interesting how some of our contributors who are more on the left saw that as a condemnation of white liberals who allow things like Charlottesville to go on without any kind of critical condemnation of it. But on the other hand, you could look at the episode just as much as an empathetic exploration of the plight of the blue-collar working man in America. And I think that sometimes South Park is able to achieve that very precise balance and tone, other times not. The show is far from perfect. There are certainly some episodes that are better than others. But in terms of how much people are getting it, I don't really know. South Park is definitely one of our more popular properties that we cover, which is why we have a whole podcast dedicated to it. So there certainly is a significant audience of people who do want to engage with it in a satirical way. And I do think that the show in general, even to the person who's just a casual viewer, does have a reputation for being a satirical show. And I think that these days, once again, when we have very strict ideological divides, satire is more important than perhaps it ever has been. And they have very nuanced takes on Trump. By the way, if anyone's listening and they say, man, I haven't seen South Park in so long, I cannot recommend enough this past season, season 21, I believe it was episode 5. It's called Doubling Down. And it is the most nuanced, intelligent, and unfortunately tragic take on Trump's America, and it's beautiful.
And as soon as you see Trump's America, some people are just, their brains are exploding right now and immediately jumping to motivated reasoning and to defending. When you even say the phrase Trump's America and nuance, I don't think a lot of people are able to look at those two things at the same time.
Right. I mean, that's definitely a frustration, is because I'm not saying that Trump is a bad president and I'm not saying Trump is a great president. I'm just saying that he is the president and things are different now than they were. And South Park is and you'll watch the episode. The episode is just as condemning of Trump as it is to the left that criticizes him no matter what he does. So, I want to make that clear that I'm not saying that Trump is super evil and South Park is making fun of them. No, South Park is saying that perhaps Trump, although not perfect, is just a symptom of a greater problem. And there are people on both sides of the aisle playing into these problems.
I'm totally on board with you. I'm a huge South Park fan. I see a lot of the nuance. I love listening to your podcast on it because I was just listening to, I think, that episode where you review that particular episode of the show. And I picked up a lot of the nuance, but you dive into some things even deeper. Some people on your team have a background in maybe philosophy, or are you just really good critics?
Most of them do have an education in philosophy. A lot of our contributors are either in or have recently left academia. In our movie podcast, Show Me the Meaning, one of our hosts, Austin, is actually a philosophy PhD. But also a movie fan. There has to be that balance. And yeah, I guess I would consider myself a critic who is a big philosophy enthusiast. And then we have one girl, one of our best writers. Her name is Amanda, and she's just like me. She's just a film nerd. She went to film school. She loves to write, and she just is very curious. And she does all her own research, and she just nails it every time. So it doesn't really, you don't really require a formal education necessarily. Now, granted, when someone like me or Amanda does our own research, we definitely do check it with the experts. But really, all you need is the curiosity and the desire to understand the material and to really dive deep into the text. And, you know, that's something that we're also very passionate about encouraging people to do.
For people to do on their own, right? You're encouraging
Absolutely.
People to watch their favorite content and take a critical look at it and think about what is this actually saying beyond just maybe in the case of Star Wars, The Last Jedi, maybe just beyond explosions, right? And there are a lot of YouTube channels. You can just turn on anything related to sci-fi, any Marvel Comics property, any Star Wars property, and you just have a bunch of fanboys or fangirls or both gushing about that particular property while not really looking objectively at anything it's actually trying to say.
Yeah, but then again, that's where all the views are. So sometimes I say to myself, who's the idiot, them or me?
True. Well, I want to know, when is a bad movie or a bad TV show just a bad movie or show? Because I'm thinking about, like, Jersey Shore. You're not going to do a close reading on that. I mean, sometimes, even with Star Wars, some people might stand back and look at, especially with Episode 7, The Force Awakens, on its surface, it's really easy to look at and say, this movie was made because Walt Disney wanted to make a bunch of money. They wanted to print money and put explosions on the screen, and they knew people would see it. And that was kind of all there is to it. So is there a line, or is there always something to be read into with popular films?
Well, I think you can bridge that. We were actually talking about this, our most recent episode that actually just came out today of our movie podcast, Show Me the Meaning. We talk about the movie The Incredibles, and there's a very interesting message about greatness in that movie. I won't go into it into too much detail.
Show Me the Meaning does a fascinating dive into The Incredibles, and you should really listen to that episode. But here's one interesting position that others have taken. It kind of channels Ayn Rand. I mean, it's a story about these highly gifted individuals that are forced to lessen their greatness to make other people comfortable. The villain is a normal guy who uses science and technology to undermine the elite and try to create a world where everyone is special and therefore no one is special. The movie even begins with a lawsuit in which the protagonist's ideals come back to bite them, which is precisely what happens in Atlas Shrugged. The parallels are uncanny.
So you're talking about is like, all right, so on the one hand, Disney just wants to make money and they're, you know, any attempt to read ideologically into the movie is really just overthinking it because all they're trying to do is make money. I just want to make sure that's the question you're asking, right?
Yeah, devil's advocate here.
Right. So I would argue that ideology is something that makes money. So I think that it's not a mistake that in the new movie, Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, one could argue, and I'm not saying this is what I believe, but one could argue that the more egalitarian message that, by the way, spoilers if you haven't seen Episode 8, we find out that Rey's parents are just these randos. It's not that she's a descendant of noble blood. And then there's a significant emphasis on these poor people who are ultimately the heroes or the people that are going to continue the cause of the rebellion at the end. There's like those poor kids on Canto Bight or whatever. And I would argue, if you look at the business model of movies, you know, it's not like Bugatti or something like that. It's not where every movie ticket costs the same amount of money. You can't say, all right, well, I'm going to see Moonlight. That's a prestige film. It's going to cost $20 a ticket. No, and then, you know, you can't say Transformers is only $10 a ticket. No, it's all one price. So you have to include messages that are going to resonate with the most amount of people. So if Star Wars Episode 8 is saying that, oh, no, there's no such thing as noble blood, anyone can be great, well, that's going to help Disney make some money. So I don't really think the two are as different as you think.
Yeah. If you do look at the original films, the kind of scum and villainy of the universe was in the cantina, right? It was people that are aliens and they kind of look different and they're just very different from everybody else. Episode 8 comes out 2017. And who are these big evil people that they lampoon and that everyone gets so much glee at messing with? It's the rich people in the casino.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Kind of one percenters, which signifies, I think, a gigantic cultural shift from the 70s.
Right. So, right, absolutely.
Yeah, so I do agree here. I just didn't know if there was a threshold. I mean, can you do a reading of The Room?
It's funny you say that. Someone wants to do that, and we might do it for April Fools. but look, like, so you mentioned the Jersey Shore. So, yeah, Jersey Shore, there's probably not a lot in the text in which we can say, oh, Snooki represents this. Now, that would be a little bit ridiculous. However, I do think that you could say that the prevalence or the popularity of Jersey Shore does say something about our culture. And I think that that would be an appropriate lens to look at it from. But sure, I mean, some things are not worth analyzing. And believe me, There are plenty of things that are super popular on YouTube that would get us a lot of views. And by the way, the whole business is based on views. So this is a pressure we deal with on a daily basis. We would love to do like super popular properties that are dumb, but there's just nothing to say. So don't think that we just kind of squeeze whatever we can out of anything. I mean, I would love to have dipped into the Five Nights at Freddy's craze. For those of you who don't know what it is, it's like a jump scare game that was literally the biggest thing in the world on YouTube for years. Probably still is. Or Minecraft. But we, you know, there's just nothing in the text there to analyze. So, I mean, we do have a standard to where we say that, okay, that's not worth analyzing. There's nothing smart to say in that, et cetera, et cetera. But I think some of our best episodes are when there's a very unexpectedly smart message. Actually, next week we're releasing a video on the newest installment of the Saw franchise, Jigsaw. Let me tell you, I watched the movie twice. First time I said, oh, there's nothing here. Second time I watched it, I was like, wait a second. I think there's a deliberate nod to a 60s French existentialist short story called No Exit. And the evidence is there. If you get a chance to watch the video, I'd love for you to email me and tell me what you think, because I think it's actually going to be one of our best videos. And I am equally shocked that French existentialist thought found its way into the new Jigsaw movie, but I think it did, and I think it was deliberate.
No Exit is a seminal one-act play by Jean-Paul Sartre. It's a particularly bleak book by a particularly bleak philosopher in a particularly bleak tradition. In it, three people are locked in a room, and I won't spoil the rest. Ever heard the saying, hell is other people? This play is where that comes from. Essentially, it's about the unbreakable tension between how you're perceived by others and how you perceive yourself.
I like how you've named three or four really popular movies and I haven't seen them at all. But as soon as you mentioned the French existentialist work No Exit, I was totally on board. I'm all about No Exit.
In Jigsaw, in one of the traps, there's a sign on one of the doors that says No Exit. And I was like, huh. And then sure enough, one of the characters goes through the exact same struggle. One of the female characters has the exact same plot points as one of the characters in No Exit. And both Jigsaw and No Exit are about the painful nature of confession. And so I was kind of blown away by that. But, I mean, it's fun when we find gems like that.
I mentioned I'm on board with South Park, big fan, longtime viewer. What is the deal with Rick and Morty? Because I haven't gotten into it. Everyone seems to either be obsessed with it or be lukewarm on it. And what do you see in it that's so valuable?
So Rick and Morty, I mean, at this point, it's a sensation. It's so popular. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so popular is really good writing. Dan Harmon is a perfectionist when it comes to structure, and he's got a writer's room of really smart people. And the premise of Rick and Morty is that we have this kind of cosmic landscape where Rick is a scientist who's literally the smartest man alive, and he can jump dimensions, and the universe is portrayed as this giant, cold, uncaring place. And the character of Rick, who's this kind of omniscient scientist, is that despite all this knowledge he has, or arguably because of all this knowledge he has, he can't find meaning in life. And he struggles with going on in life because existence is just this big void to him. And so the show deals with a lot of existentialist and specifically nihilistic themes, and we actually just made a video recently about nihilism in Rick and Morty and BoJack Horseman. And I think that those issues of finding meaning in life, of knowing what to do once the illusion has been shattered, whether it be a religious illusion or some sort of other idealistic illusion, I think that disillusionment in general is something that our generation is dealing with a lot, whether it's the idealistic life that you've been sold as a child through media. You know, once that illusion is shattered, what do you do? How do you find meaning in life once meaning has been constructed with so many years through those idealistic images? Similarly with religion. And Rick and Morty is all about that. It's all about the struggle to find meaning once you live in a reality in which there are no illusions to comfort you. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why the show is so popular, and specifically why it's so popular on our channel, because there's a great overlap in that we are a channel that is dedicated to talking about meaning, and Rick and Morty is a funny, very entertaining show about the pursuit of meaning and perhaps the futile pursuit of meaning. And so I think it's a mix of being a great show and reflecting on ideas that are really things that people are struggling with today, especially young people.
That now I'm compelled to watch it or watch more of it. I've seen a couple episodes and I enjoyed them, which is,
I would say the first couple episodes of season one, if you're watching it chronologically, it takes about till like episode four to get into the groove. And then from then on through season three, it's all just top shelf television.
And on your Rick and Morty podcast, you've had writers on the podcast, right?
Yeah, we had recently Brian Weissall, who was a writer on season two and recently just launched his own show called Hot Streets.
Other than consuming all of Wisecrack's content, and you've delivered your message many different ways with, again, Thug Notes, 8-Bit Philosophy, Earthling Cinema. There's so many different ways that you deliver this and so many different voices. So if somebody's not attracted to one, they may love another. Other than checking out all of Wisecrack's really smart content, which I really do think is really cool stuff, how can I sit down, if I'm the average person, I have no background in philosophy, maybe I never went to college, never did a lot of reading of classic literature, how can I look at a film and understand or think about it in a way that will allow me to enjoy it more on a deeper level? Or is that your job?
I mean, that's kind of my job. The thing I always tell people is that focus on the ending. The ending is where you'll get the strongest ideological statement, especially if you're talking about a movie, which is why it's a lot harder to analyze an ongoing TV series. So, for example, people always ask us, do philosophy of Game of Thrones. It's almost impossible to do that because we don't know what the conclusion is. And the conclusion is what gives you that ideological statement. You always have to ask yourself, how is it that the protagonist achieves salvation? Usually in most stories, they achieve salvation in some way or another. And the way that they overcome their conflict is usually where the ideological statement lies. So, for example, in The Dark Knight at the end, and I hope everyone has seen The Dark Knight because it's probably my favorite movie of that last decade. So Batman has to lie and say that Harvey Dent was noble until the end and he takes responsibility for the murders. And so you could argue that the ideological statement is that even the greatest ideal can be torn down, but it requires a platonic noble lie in order to keep society together. So that's a way that you can read it, and it's all based on the conclusion. How does Batman save the day? It's not by beating up the Joker. It's not by calming the people of Gotham. It's by a lie, and a lie that maintains a pure image of a Christ-like ideal.
I would like to wrap up with the Curiosity Challenge, and I'll give you a break for a second. I'm actually going to ask you a trivia question about something I read on Curiosity.com and see if you know about this.
Okay.
Keeping in the film category, since that's what we've been talking about for the whole episode. So the U.S. Library of Congress in Washington is home to more than 160 million books and recordings and photos and manuscripts. But not everything is kept there. 75 miles to the southwest near the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, there is a facility that houses 6.3 million collection items, 140,000 reels of film. And those reels include classics like Casablanca, even nitrate film, an old medium that's kept in its own vaults because it's highly flammable. It is called the Packard Campus of the National Audiovisual Conservation Center. It's a 415,000 square foot facility. It is a converted facility. Can you tell me what the facility used to be and what it was originally designed to house?
So this is going to be a pure guess, but I'm going to guess that it used to be a prison and it used to house inmates.
Ooh, good guess. Very good guess. But that is not the correct answer.
Ah.
It was opened in 1969 during the Cold War and was originally a nuclear bunker designed to house $4 billion in gold, enough to replenish the U.S. cash supply east of the Mississippi River should the unthinkable happen. At the time of its construction, it was reportedly the world's largest single-floor vault.
So did you guys know that? Okay, good. I don't feel that stupid. The two people next to me didn't know that either.
It's supposed to be obscure. But anyway, you can read about that on Curiosity.com. And I believe you brought a question for me.
I did. Cody, what is the world's most expensive coffee and why?
Is it coffee from Antarctic? No, that doesn't make sense. Oh, boy. I'm going to say from France because it's on a really rich vineyard.
It's civet coffee. It's coffee that is ingested by a civet and then defecated out and then made into coffee. What is a civet? Yeah, it's like a nocturnal weaselly thing. It's apparently very unethical. It's kind of like the what is that thing with the ducks that that delicacy that requires you to do something inhumane to a duck? Foie gras.
Wow. How much is it? Do you know?
$50 for an 8-ounce bag. It's called Kopi Luwak is the name of the coffee.
Kopi Luwak coffee. All right.
Actually, the civet actually looks kind of cute.
This is the weirdest trivia question. Our producer just pulled up a image. It's kind of cute. It's like a little bear, kind of. We'll have links in the show notes to all of your properties, so we're going to have a very long show notes. Jared, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Cody.
What time is it? It's extra credit question time. This week's extra credit question comes from Ramses, and it's all about time. Ramses wants to know why all the watches and advertisements are always set to 10 past 10. If you have a question you'd like answered on a future show, send it in an email with your name to podcast@curiosity.com. The answer after this.
If you want to hear more from Jared, then believe it or not, he's on three different podcasts from Wisecrack. I seriously don't know how he has time to do them all. I'll warn you that they are explicit podcasts, meaning that they include adult language, so parents, you might not want to let your kids listen until they're a bit more grown up. But for consenting adults, you can find links to all of Wisecrack's podcasts in the show notes of this episode, including links to Respect Our Authorita, a South Park podcast, The Squanch, a Rick and Morty podcast, and of course, the film podcast, Show Me the Meaning. If you want to hear more of me and Jared, then check out the episode of Show Me the Meaning from February 16th, 2018, in which we all discuss the 1997 film Gattaca. It would mean a lot to both me and to the Wisecrack team if you have some time to check out that episode while you're waiting for us to release the next exciting episode of the Curiosity Podcast. Again, listener discretion is advised, but it's all really smart stuff. Thanks for checking it out. And if you do check it out, then please let us know what you think.
It's time for the extra credit answer. Ramses wanted to know why watch ads always set the time to 10:10. First, let's dive into the myths. It's not to memorialize Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, or Martin Luther King Jr. Even though people say 10:10 is when they died, it wasn't. They all died at different times of day. It's also not the time the bomb was dropped on either Nagasaki or Hiroshima. What it is nice aesthetics. When an analog watch is set to 10:10, it makes sure the hands aren't overlapping so you can fully appreciate what they look like. They don't cover the other features like date windows, which are usually placed near the 3, 6, or 9. And they elegantly frame the logo. That's it. Next time you see a watch ad, keep an eye out for what time it's set to. Thanks for your question.
And thanks again to Ruben Westmus, our colleague, for just amazing research on this episode.
Yeah, he's really smart about philosophy. I was really happy to have his help.
Yeah, you two did a rock star job, and you don't have the flu anymore.
Hooray!
It's so cool. And our next episode is going to be big.
Big!
Like, really big.
Oh, I'm so excited about that one.
We are going to talk to Dr. Michio Kaku, who is...
He's huge!
He's a theoretical physicist, and he's written a book about the future of humanity.
He writes a lot of books about just the future of everything. The future of the mind, the future of technology. It's really fun. It's like sci-fi, except without the fi. It's great.
Yeah, he talks about stuff that I didn't think was a thing, but is going to be a thing, or is a thing. It's just out of control. So check us out next week, and again, check out all of the really cool content from Wisecrack. They've got a lot of stuff on YouTube. They can tend to be a little bit more clean than some of their podcasts, which are all explicit, again. But all still good stuff. Good and smart. Just like us.
Just like us.
And with that... We're done this week. I'm Cody Goff.
I'm Ashley Hamer.
Thanks for listening.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.